What's up, everybody? Welcome to One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell, presented by SodaStick. Great episode today. I know I say that a lot, but I am thrilled to be joined by a former NHL enforcer, spent a couple of years with the Minnesota Wild, played for seven NHL teams, racked up more than 500 career NHL penalty minutes, plus another 200 games in the American Hockey League, almost 500 penalty minutes in the AAA League they call the Jungle. And that's where I got to know this guy, the big man, John Scott. That's right, the Edmonton native John Scott is going to join me momentarily. Really thrilled to have him on the podcast. He's got a podcast of his own called Dropping the Gloves. You can find it on all major podcast platforms. You can follow him on Twitter at @JohnScott_32. That's at @JohnScott_32. But back to SodaStick for a minute. Proud sponsor of One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell. Go to SodaStick.com to get your original Minnesota-inspired goods. Got to check them out. One of my favorite designs is one of their newest hats. It's an all-white hat with Mike Modano's number 9 in a rectangle right front and center with the North Stars colors. It's sleek. It's clean. It's fresh. Love it. My kids have already stolen a bunch of their hats that I got from SodaStick. I don't blame them. They're awesome. Don't forget, use code One-on-One for 15% off. That's right, 15% off your next order. Use code One-on-One. That's SodaStick.com. Designed by Minnesotans for Minnesotans. Code One-on-One for 15% off your next order. Speaking of Mike Modano, he was part of the crazy game of hockey last weekend at Tria Rink in St. Paul. It was a weekend-long charitable event benefiting the Minnesota Wild Foundation. Great job by Andrew Height, the man they call Whitey, to put on this event. He had the VIP event Friday night. You had the charitable hockey game on Saturday at Tria, and then the Corey Wong and OAR concert at the Armory in Minneapolis. Just an unbelievable weekend. The celebrities seemed to have a great time. Everybody bought in. It was so well run, so much fun. And the concert, boy, the Armory, what a venue that place is. The game was great, and it just seemed like everybody came out for a good cause and have a great time, and we hope it's the first of many. But Mike Modano was there, and boy, he can still snap it around. Like, if Billy Guerin is looking for a hopefully cheap one-year deal, bring in the 2014 Hockey Hall of Famer Mike Modano, who's already helping out the organization at a front office level. Him and Billy Guerin go way back. I said to Mike after the game, hey, it looks like you could still play. You know, the Wild don't have a lot of cap space, but he kind of joked that he'd come in on the cheap. But it was really fun to see comedians, actors, actresses, former NFLers, former NHLers, local celebrities, musicians get together for a great weekend. So awesome job again by the Wild, led by Andrew Height and his efforts there to put that thing together. So just a lot of fun this past weekend. And again, my thanks to SodaStick for sponsoring One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell. All right, here he is, the big man, former Minnesota Wild player and longtime NHLer, enforcer John Scott. We'll give you a little background of our guest today. Earlier, longtime NHLer, spent a bunch of seasons in the AHL as well, almost 1,000 career penalty minutes in his pro career. Again, follow him on Twitter at @JohnScott_32 and check out his podcast called Dropping the Gloves on all major podcast platforms. I am absolutely grateful to be joined today by a guy I came across 15 years ago now. My first year in the American Hockey League, John Scott. What's up, buddy?
Not much, Joe. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. NHL.com says you were 6'8", 260. Was that accurate?
Now or when I played?
When you played.
No, you know, I usually would come into camp around 273, and I would leave around 260. I would lose a lot of weight during the season, so they're pretty close.
Did you prefer wing or D? Was it back and forth at times in your career, and which did you prefer?
Yeah, I was back and forth in the NHL throughout my whole career, really. The switch happened in Chicago. We were up against the salary cap, and we had a bunch of injuries up front, and I was kind of the seventh defenseman. We had, like, I think three Hall of Famers on the back end and then a couple of veterans, and I was just the odd man out most nights. So they threw me up front. I started, you know, winning fights and fighting more a little bit when I was up front, and the coach, Joe Quinville, just decided to keep me up there. And it was a weird season where some games I would play both. I'd play defense, forward, I'd bounce back and forth on the bench and other, you know, then I wouldn't play for 7 or 8 games. So it was a strange season. And then the following season is where I really just moved to forward the whole season. And I played the majority of my time at forward. And after that, it was just strictly forward. I think if there was an injury rash, I would play a couple, you know, games on defense here and there, but no, it happened in Chicago, but I much prefer defense. I'm not a goal scorer. You know that I don't have a nose for the net. I think you learn how to forecheck, you know, and you learn how to do those things in the minor leagues and growing up. And I just had no clue. So it was just a disaster. My forward career, I was awful.
It would say though, that the transition, I think the logic would tell you going from D to forward be easier than the opposite. So how was the transition?
Well, I was so passive, I guess is the word, where I would, for my first couple years, I would be the third defenseman. I would just be kind of floating around the blue line because I was so nervous about being beat up the ice or being at a position where I wasn't aggressive and my line mates hated it. They're like, get your ass in front of the net. Like, let's go start forechecking. do what you're supposed to do. And I would be so apprehensive and nervous about being at a position where I just like, I would finish the season even because I wouldn't score any goals and the other team wouldn't score on us. But it took a few years for me to get comfortable and saying, okay, it's okay to be behind, you know, the other team's net. It's okay to forecheck. It's okay to, you know, to get after the puck a little bit, but it's the mindset is the hardest part.
Now, was there any talk of a net front power play opportunity for John Scott? Cause Chara did it at one point in his career. And obviously he's a massive human as well.
Yeah, I've done it. Again, I'm not a goal scorer. Chara had better hands than I did. He probably still does. But I tried it on a few teams. I think I tried it with Buffalo. I tried it with Chicago. I would end up getting in a fight with the defenseman or a goalie because they'd be hacking my legs. The D-man would be crossing my back. And I just had a short fuse. And I would just end up taking a penalty. So it was just like, I don't know. It didn't work out. I enjoyed trying, and I'm sure guys were pissed. They're like, seeing me on the power play, like, this guy's got one career goal and now he's on the power play in the NHL, what's this about? But no it was there, but it just didn't work out. Like Chara actually, that Bruins power play was lethal with Marchand and him and Bergeron, and yeah, it didn't work out for me, unfortunately.
Give me some of the skilled players that you played with that you really just were impressed by and sort of wowed by at times. And you mentioned some of those Blackhawks, you know, players that are now winding down their careers, but just some of those great players from your day that, you know, even maybe still today, you look back and I can't believe I played with that guy.
Well, the one guy, and I'm doing a homer move here. I was actually just thinking about and talking about it the other day, was Marian Gaborik.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of guys have great hands. A lot of guys have vision. I play with like the best passers in the league. I've, you know, Patrick Kane is the best vision ever. I play with Joe Thornton. He's everybody knows Jumbo. Gabby was one of, if the most skilled player I've ever played with. The way he could handle the puck and make moves at full speed is incredible. It reminds me of Connor McDavid. McDavid's a step quicker, but I think top end speed, Gabby was faster. I think McDavid gets there quicker, but man, he was a treat. I got to play with him in Minnesota, then again with the Rangers. And he was so incredibly skilled and so powerful. I think there'll never be a player quite like him again, where he was just so electric every time he was on the ice. And I'm not just, like I said, I'm not doing this because I'm homering the Minnesota Wild, but man, was he so skilled. And it was sad when he was in Minnesota, because when we were there, he really didn't have much around him. You know, he would play with Pierre-Marc Bouchard. We had like Mikko Koivu. We had some okay talent around him, but nothing. Like McDavid has Draisaitl. He has some other, you know, grade A guys. Gabby was the lone wolf here in Minnesota for a lot of years, and he still put up insane amounts, playing for Jacques Lemaire too, who was just, don't cross the red line or else you're going to be benched. Yeah. So, you know, he was an incredible talent.
Later on, I had planned to talk to you a little bit about the code and protecting players and all that sort of thing. But since you bring up Gaborik, I might as well get to it. Did a player like that, did Marian Gaborik appreciate the protection and the ice that somebody like you could buy for the rest of the team?
Oh, without a doubt. He wouldn't say much, just because when I was there with him, we had Boogie. And so I think Boogie were close, and he had Boogie, like, he was the best that ever did his job. But when I went to Buffalo, when I went to Chicago, I had players come up to me, like Thomas Vanek said, it's night and day from when you're on the ice and when you're not. Like he really appreciated me being on the ice. All the guys in Chicago, everybody in San Jose, they knew what I brought to the table. I didn't put up many points, but you check my win-loss record. It's pretty solid. And I played on some bad teams in Buffalo and Arizona and San Jose. I always had a winning record when I was on the ice, and the skill guys always had career years. So I don't know. Maybe it's a fluke, but everywhere I went, the top guys put up some pretty good points, and they never got injured. They never got ran because I made it my job to go in there. And I knew, you know, who buttered my bread. It was the Stars. And if they at the end of the year said, okay, we like this guy, we want to bring him back, I was going to get a contract again. So I made my point. If anybody touched a top guy, I was going to beat their head in. And that's what I tried to do. So
you mentioned the late Derek Boogaard, and obviously what a tragedy that was, and so unfortunate for his family and the game of hockey. And you said he was the best to ever do it. You really mean that? Like, I mean, you came up through the American League, you fought some tough guys. I saw it firsthand. I was going back through your 2008, like game by game log in the American Hockey League, and trying to see some of the guys you fought along the way when I was there that season. And then you saw it at the NHL level, the toughest of the toughest. Where does Derek Boogaard rank?
He's number one, I think, without a doubt. I think when you look back at his resume and what he did when he was around, there was no one who compared to him. I've talked to all the tough guys. Like, I've talked to the George Larocques, I've talked to the Fedorics, all of these guys who were around the same time as him, and they were terrified of Derek. And he fought everybody. He took on all comers, and he wouldn't just win a fight. Like, I would win a fight. I wasn't knocking guys out and putting guys to sleep and putting them in the hospital for months. Derek would end careers, you know? And he had this mentality of I'm going, like, he enjoyed fighting. He enjoyed hurting people. And there are not many guys who have that mentality. And he did his job, and he did it very well. It's sad how it ended. Like you said, it's tragic. But in my eyes, in my era, he was by far the best heavyweight there was. Everyone was terrified of him, Joe. Everybody, all the tough guys. When I left Minnesota and he was in New York, I would get prodded all the time. Are you going to fight Derek? Are you going to fight Derek? Luckily, I didn't have to. Like, I would have, and he would have beat my doors off probably, but he was feared throughout the league.
You still talk to players today. I know you had Ryan Reeves on last week. You had Milan Lucic on today, or I guess yesterday it dropped on dropping the gloves. But like, when you talk to these guys, even if it may be off the record, do they say things have changed? The code has changed. The game is obviously different now. There's less of those, hey, heavyweight enforcers. You know, some teams still have them. I hate to say it's a dying breed, but you see it. Like,
no, it's dead. Nobody has one. I was. You mentioned Revo, Ryan Reeves, on his pod, like on my show last week. He was like, "Yeah, I'm the toughest guy, or one of the top two." And I'm like, "Revo, how big are you?" He's 6'2", 220. You know, like that's a far cry from the Steve McIntyres,
yeah,
the Brian McGrattans, the Bordalos, the Boogaards, and myself, who are 6'6", 260. You know what I mean? There's something to be said about someone who's just physically scary to line up against. And I know when I used to line up against Revo, you know, God bless him, he did well with the Wild. He's the last, one of the few remaining heavies. I was not worried about him.
Right.
Not one bit, not one iota. Like, I know I can handle him fairly easily. It's just for my size. And I think I was one of the last, you know, guys who was truly just like a monster out there. And now it's more, you have to bring more stuff to the table. Revo can score. He can play. He can keep up with the, you know, the pace of the play. And it's okay to say it's the breed is dead. You know, the dinosaurs went away, and it's all right. We've evolved. Now you have other tough guys like Luch is still kicking. You got Revo. You got McDermott in Colorado. You got some other guys scattered throughout the league. But yeah, it's a different game for sure.
Let's go back to Michigan Tech for a minute. You spent four seasons there, and then you turned pro. And I'm curious how the opportunity with the Minnesota Wild first came about. But start with the collegiate days at Michigan Tech and how that experience was for you.
Oh, it was beautiful. I got exactly one scholarship offer, and it was not a full ride. It was a partial ride. It was to Michigan Tech, and I took it right away. So I might have gotten more offers, but I took the first one I had. And I went up to Northern Michigan knowing nothing about the NCAA league at all. And we were bad. We were last place, I think, every year. Maybe we finished ahead of Alaska one year. But it was a great 4 years. It allowed me to kind of grow my game. I was this big, tall, lanky kid who didn't know how to play hockey very well. And I got some good ice time. And more importantly, I just kind of grew as a person. I got to go to class 5 days a week and just kind of, you know, just stretch my legs and grow a little bit. And it was a great way for me to grow overall. I wasn't just thrust into the OHL and, you know, you're a professional right away and it's sink or swim and then you're done. I had a bunch of stuff I needed to work on, and Michigan Tech just molded me. And now I work mechanical engineering here in Traverse City, Michigan. I played in the NHL. I feel like that was the best decision to go to Michigan Tech, and it paid off in spades. It was such a good decision to go there.
Traverse City, man, that's a beautiful spot. I've been up there for that NHL Prospects Tournament. Unfortunately, Minnesota doesn't participate in it anymore, but I think I went up there three different times. What a spot that is.
Yeah, it's a good, you know, right on the lake. My wife was raised here, and we just settled down. It's, yeah, don't tell anybody because it's starting to grow, and I'm like, dang it, come on. Yeah. Like, but it's a good spot.
Dillinger's?
Yeah, the double wide. It's there. Yeah. With seven kids, it's hard to sneak away for a drink every now and again. So I don't go to your stomping grounds, Joe. You're still hip and young. I'm old and crusty.
All right. Now that you crossed the bridge with the seven girls, I gotta go there next. Your Twitter profile is basically like retired NHL tough guy, seven beautiful daughters. And I was like, he wouldn't put this in here if it was four or five kids. Like, I mean, but I'm still mind blown. Seven girls.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's grown. It used to be five, I think, and then it's six and seven. And of course, hopefully it goes to 8, 9, 10. We'll see. But yeah, I just can't figure it out. I don't know how to do the whole boy thing.
All right. Well, have you found out? So my wife and I have three boys, 12, 10, and 8, and we didn't find out the gender before any of them were delivered. Did you guys find out?
We only found out for the twins just because we had so many doctor's appointments and they were just like, everyone, do you want to find out the sex? Do you want to? And finally, I was just like, yes, please tell me. But for the other five, no, we did not find out.
Wow. And what does your wife say about the seven girls? Was she looking for a boy at some point? Could that be in the future?
She wants a boy because I know you can maybe relate, but boys love their moms. They just are all over their moms, but girls love the dad. So I get home and I'm like superhero and she's just like, this sucks. So yeah, she wants a boy desperately, I think. And so do I, because I don't know if I can watch another girls softball game where every player gets walked and it's just the most boringest thing in my life, but a boy would be fun. But you know, what are you going to do? It is what it is.
All right. Tell us about the day job that you just referenced.
Oh, just mechanical engineering here in Traverse City.
Oh,
Michigan.
No big deal. Mechanical engineering.
I don't know. It's like Apollo Engineering. We do kind of MEP stuff, mechanical, electrical, plumbing for buildings. We do mostly commercial stuff. And I've just been doing that for a few years now, and it's been good. And then I do my podcast, and I'm going to be actually working with a NHL team this coming season doing pre and post game for TV. So that should be fun.
I'm guessing you can't share that since you just didn't, or can we share
not
that?
Quite yet. It's not okay. The Wild. They didn't reach out yet.
Oh, well, I'll text somebody when we get done here.
I would have said yes to Minnesota over this team.
How do you have time for all this? I mean, your podcast, I was checking out the Lucic episode this morning before you jumped on, and I'm like, you put out three episodes in the last week or so. So how do you find time for the mechanical engineering, the podcast, the family? What's that balance like?
Oh, I don't see my family at all. Yeah. we're like ships in the night. No. You know, I do my podcast from my office, and I just kind of, podcasting is easy. Everybody does it. You just kind of fire it up and let it rip. And I'm lucky enough to be able to get some guests from the NHL, and it's easy and you have a good conversation. And I don't know, during the season, we just talk about whatever, you know, Joe, there's always something going on. You rip on the Leafs, you make fun of the Wild a little bit, you just, you know, go on your way. And then with the TV thing, that's going to be interesting. I don't know how we're going to make that work, but I'm going to just dip my toe in this year, maybe do 20 or 30 games and see how it goes.
Let's circle back to the opportunity to turn pro. Did Tom Lynn reach out, the old Minnesota Wild assistant GM? Was he like driving around the station wagon scouting you in Northern Michigan?
He definitely was. That's so funny. Yeah. So Tom Lynn, I was in Michigan Tech, and our first introduction was I was going to be signed to an East Coast contract. So my first contract was an East Coast deal, and I was going to play in Pensacola. And I went down for camp in the AHL, and the idea was I would practice with the Houston Aeros, would play games with the Pensacola, whatever their name was.
Ice Pilots.
Ice Pilots. lo and behold, Houston was terrible for the first five or six games. And they just said, you know what? You can play. And so I started playing in Houston. I had to sign an AHL deal. I did that. So now I'm on a two-way East Coast AHL deal. After that season, I caught the eye of the Wild and I signed a two-way AHL NHL deal. And then it was kind of the rest was history. I just, you know, played another year and a half in the AHL and then jumped up to the Minnesota Wild after that. And I never left. So it's kind of funny how a team being just absolutely atrocious the first year with the Houston Aeros gave me my opportunity to play. And then kind of the rest is history there. And I jumped over first round draft picks all the time. Like, it was funny playing with these guys like Sean Bell and Clayton Stoner and Eric Reitz and all these, you know, high draft picks. And it's, I don't know, this is a whole other podcast, but just seeing the competitive nature and guys getting called up and how pissed they are that you get called up and seeing guys overtake you and where the pecking order is. And it's an interesting dynamic being in the AHL. It really is.
Yeah, it's a reality of that league, even still, right? And now they have, of course, the veteran rule in there, so they want younger prospects in the AHL. When really you broke in, it was a lot of older guys, obviously still trying to grind it out. But
oh man, I remember going into Peoria, and I'm like, they have like former NHL tough guys, and they're just like screaming at me, Rocky Thompson, for Pete's sake, who should have been long retired. Like I think when I fought him, he was like 40, and I'm like, what are you doing in the AHL? It was a weird dynamic before the veteran rule. It was a tough league. Like there, every team had four or five legit heavyweights. It was a zoo, Joe. Yeah. Everywhere we would go, it would just be fight night.
Yeah. It's a lot of hired guns, essentially, right? Like you look, the Chicago Wolves, I don't even know if they had an affiliate then. They were just paying guys $500,000 or more to, you know, the Jason Krogs of the world. I know, and Haydar, like,
They had a good talent. Team.
Yeah.
They had some good teams, and they would have some, they had everything a little bit, and they would always win. You know, we had Danny Erman and Ryan Hamilton and Benoit Pouliot and myself. We were okay, but not really a contender.
What'd you think of Houston?
Loved it. Well, I'll say this. So I went down there my first full year. I knew I was going to be down there. I brought my bike. I brought everything. I was going to, you know, explore Houston. It's just a concrete jungle.
Yeah.
You don't go anywhere unless you're driving like 6-7 miles.
To a strip mall, by the way.
Yeah. It's a very spread out city. It's massive. I enjoyed it. We had our little gated community. I lived with, like I just mentioned, I lived with Ryan Hamilton and Danny Erman and Paul Albers and Cal Clutterbuck. We all had a room together. We paid $99 a month. We would do practice. We'd grab a case of beer and we'd go down to the pool. And that was our routine. And it was
Stafford,
fantastic.
Texas there at the, I'm trying to think of that gate that like, it was right by Sam's boat.
Yeah. It was Sugarland.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was such a great life. I really enjoyed my time. Yeah. We go to Sam's boat. We really enjoyed our first couple of years of pro, and especially the guys who are first rounders, they got the big bonus. They're rolling around in Escalades. And I think the Lincoln Navigator was the big one back then that changed colors. And we had some fun. I'll tell you what. And then Kevin Constantine came in and ruined everything. But before that, it was a good time in Houston. I really enjoyed playing there.
Well, Luke, I just crossed paths with Luke Strand. He was in town for the crazy game of hockey. He's now coaching at Minnesota State Mankato. I haven't seen him in quite some time, but yeah, he was on that coaching staff my first year in Houston. Your last year in Houston, 08-09 with Troy Ward and KC and Luke Strand. But yeah, that's definitely a blast from the past, I'm sure, for not only yourself, but me as well. Man, just do you think that market can make it in the NHL? Because I do in a lot of ways, and then I have some hesitation, some reservations about it.
I'm going to be honest, and I don't think they can. I don't know. I do know that when we were in Houston, when I played there, and we were a really good team, like we were really good, I think my second year, we were going into playoffs, football started, baseball started. We went from averaging like 5,000 or 6,000 fans a game, playoffs started, and we got like 1,000 fans.
Yeah.
And it was just like, why? What happened? Oh, okay. You know, the Astros are starting up, the football team, the Texans are starting up, and everybody just shifted their attention to that sport because hockey is, you know, the third string in Houston. Fourth, now that, you know, the Rockets are doing fairly okay. I just don't, it's a big city, but I just don't know. You know, I see how Arizona's doing. I see how the Panthers are doing. I see how the Stars have struggled unless they're making the Stanley Cup Finals. It's a tough nut to crack down in the South. And I don't know. I hope they get a chance. They got a good, you know, good arena. It's a big enough market, but it's so hard to sell the game in the South. It really is, because even high school football, we would go to practice and there would be like 10,000, 12,000 people at a high school football game. It's like, holy cow, this, like, football's number one down there for sure.
Your first career NHL goal came with the Minnesota Wild. Walk me through it.
Oh, in Carolina, I think we were down 3-1 or 3-0 entering the third period. I think Robbie Earl scored the first goal. I was playing defense. A shot came from the point, and I found myself in front of the net, and I just picked up a lazy rebound and poked it past Cam Ward, I want to say was the goaltender for Carolina. And I had a broken nose at the time. I broke it the night before. So the guys came barreling in to celebrate, and I'm trying to move my head away a little bit because, like, my nose was completely crushed. And it was a good moment, because I was, I think, well into my second year and I still hadn't scored. So it was a massive monkey on my back. And you start to think about the all-time record of games played without a goal, and you're like, man, I'm only like 40 games away from that. I got to get on this. And finally I scored, and I think we ended up losing that game in overtime maybe, but it was a neat little moment. Yeah.
Do you still have the game puck?
I do. I got the game puck. I got, like, the ticket stub. Fans are so great. Out of the blue, someone just sends me, like, the ticket stubs for the game. And we were playing in Carolina, and some fan randomly sends me a ticket stub from that game. I'm like, that's so nice of people to, like, go out of their way to do that. So I have those little mementos. Yeah.
All right. The old AHL days, you touched on it. I went and looked. All right. So in 2007, 2008 in the American Hockey League, there were 19 players in the league with 200 plus penalty minutes. You don't get anybody with 200 plus PIMs anymore. We're not going back that far, obviously. You were 28th in a league with 184. I got to spend some time with you talking about that era, the old jungle where you, like you said, it was fight night, and every building you went into, you knew there was somebody on the other side that was either maybe more seasoned in that department or just as big or has nothing to lose.
Yeah, you nailed it exactly. There was guys clawing, and it's all to get to the NHL. And so you would go to a rink and you would see, okay, who is their tough guy? I need to make an impression. I need to, you know, beat their wheels off. And so that's how it was. And if you got up by two goals or you're down by two goals, you're getting jumped or you're jumping somebody. There was no qualms about, are we going to fight? Are we not fighting? There was no gray area. It's, we're fighting whether you like it or not. And that's all there was to it. So it was just, you had to be ready. You can get jumped at any time. I remember we played Peoria at home. I fought Hans Benson, and I did fairly well. I fought someone else on the way to the box who was chirping. And then Matt Roy, a former Houston player, jumped off the bench and grabbed me, and I fought him, and which was only like a one-punch thing. But I got three fights in on the way to the penalty box. And so I get kicked out of the game. I see Matt Roy, and I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I wasn't playing. I just wanted to get out of here to go to the bar. I was like, what? And so it was a jungle. It's not like it is today where they're kind of growing skill, and it's a feeder league to the NHL, and it's only skill. Back then, you did anything you could to get noticed by a scout. And that usually meant either hitting somebody dirty or just grabbing somebody and fighting them. I remember I dummied Mike Brown in Winnipeg, because he did something and he wouldn't fight. And so I just grabbed and I broke his jaw. And I talked to him. He's like, yeah, you didn't even give me a chance to say yes. You just grabbed me and beat the tar off of me. I was like, yeah, that's how it worked. You just grabbed somebody and started throwing. So it was a different league than it is today. It's more akin to maybe the East Coast, how it was a few years back, but even the East Coast is changing now and they're getting rid of fighting and they're trying to clean it up a little bit. So it was fun, right? The games were enjoyable. You called them. It was never a dull moment. I remember fighting in the bench in Chicago, like taking Boris Valabek and throwing him in the bench, and we're literally like throwing punches in the bench by the coaches, and the refs are like, let him go. Let him tire out. Like, it was just insane.
Do you remember Matt Cassian?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So Cass was, it was 2008, 2009 Houston, and the Arrows went on an East Coast trip. And I don't remember if you were on this trip or not. Could have been in the NHL. But it was like Worcester and Bingo and Syracuse and Wilkes-Barre, Bugard's little brother was playing for the Baby Penguins at that time. And we just went out for a week and played all these East Coast teams. And I remember still vividly Matt Cassian in a restaurant. I don't know where we were, Binghamton or whatever, like in the hotel lobby restaurant. And he's now gone through Morasty and Yablonski, and his face looked like, you know, he had been punched 30 times. Like his knuckles were all, and I just remember being like, this is my first year in the league again. I'm like, this is insane for these guys.
Yeah, the East was always the worst because, like you mentioned, there was those guys, and it was just every city. Out East was definitely more tougher than the West. I remember going into Syracuse, and the game before we played them, we kind of got the better of them. They had a couple guys sitting out due to injury or whatever. During warmups, they had Konopka, they had Morasty, and they had Derek Sugden. They're three heavies. They were reading papers on the bench. They weren't even taking warmups. They had the newspaper out and they were reading papers. And I was like, holy moly. Like, this is insane to me. You're just reading papers. And yeah, sure enough, three fights out of the game. It was a different time. And it wasn't that long ago. Like it was,
right.
It seems like a million years ago, but it was only like 15 years ago. So it was fun, you know, as a young kid, I enjoyed it, but man, it was terrifying going into those cities.
I was trying to recall a night in Houston. I thought the team was in Hamilton, but I remember Kevin Constantine telling me that you fought somebody, and he told me this like after the game or whatever. I mean, not just me, but that you went off down to the tunnel and you showed your hand to the bench on your way off. I'm pretty sure it was you. I thought it was Hamilton. I couldn't find the box score where you fought in Hamilton that year. I don't even think you played a game for the Arrows in Hamilton in that one specific season.
It was Iowa.
It was Iowa. Okay. How ironic is that, having spent eight seasons there myself? But so is Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines, but your finger was like sideways. And he said he almost threw up on the bench. The head coach, when you come off smiling after a fight, you take your glove off and you show everybody your fingers like sideways. Is that somewhat accurate?
Yeah, pretty close. I was fighting Troy Bodie, I believe. Smaller guy, but feisty, probably 6'4". And I was, you know, doing pretty well. I went to throw a punch and I missed his head and I hit his collarbone with my thumb. And my thumb just completely, it's called a compound dislocation, where the knuckle just dislocates totally and the both bones break through the skin. And so I continue fighting because you're all jacked up and you don't really feel anything in the fight. And then I hear the ref screaming at me, "Scotty, stop, stop." Because I'm throwing with my right still and my thumb is dangling in the skin. And the only thing dangling in the air, the only thing hanging on is the ligaments in your thumb. And it could have easily fallen off if I would have hit it again and I would have just had no thumb. But anyways, we stopped the fight and I finally gather myself and the ref's like, "Hey, look at your hand, man. Like something's not going on." And it wasn't bleeding because it would just happened. And I look down and both of the bones are sticking out of the skin and my thumb is completely folded over to the side. And you can like dangle it around like it's like a fishing lure on a rod. And so I'm just like, this is not good. And so I skate off the ice and everyone's like, "Go to the penalty box. What are you doing?" And I'm like, I look at him kind of smiling, like, "Think I can go get this checked out?" And so I just went down the tunnel and it was one of the weirdest moments where the trainer didn't know what to do because this never happens. And the trainers aren't, you know, they're not NHL worthy, no offense, but you know, they were kind of shocked as well. And so he's trying to go find the doctor and I'm sitting here staring at this thumb. And it's starting to bleed now. And I'm like, okay, like it's guys. And so I just take the thumb and I kind of lift it up and throw it back on and pop it on. And I start to move it just a little bit. And I'm like, all right, like we're fine now, right? Because my thumb works. We can just stitch up. There was a huge gash. Just stitch that up and go back to work. Scouts were there from Minnesota. Like it's a close game to Iowa. I wanted to get back on the ice, but went to the hospital, got it stitched up. But no, they never took it back off or checked anything. And I have limited movement still on my thumb, but yeah, it was, I've never seen that before or since where, yeah, it was bone out, hand flying everywhere. And just kind of, it was so weird. Yeah. So that was in Iowa.
You got to help me remember. Did you came back and finished playing?
No, they wouldn't let me.
Okay.
I wanted to, but he's like, "We have to go get it disinfected. We have to get it stitched up." So I went to the hospital in my gear and the bus came and picked me up after the game.
Some might say that you know, having video on a podcast is a good thing. Had we had video on this podcast in those moments, my facial reaction would have probably been like, you need to take me to the hospital after just hearing you relay that story, my man. That's
it was before phones were on or cameras were on phones, unfortunately. Right. Cause I would have loved to have, you know, someone in the stands snap a picture. It was I'm glad Kevin saw that and said that. Cause no one has really said anything about that ever. And I was like, I lost my finger almost, you guys.
Yeah. How much prep did you do before a fight? Now, I'm not privy to this in the NHL, you know, like in the minor league where you can pretty much roll through the locker room at any point before a game, right? Like, that was one advantage of being in the AHL is you had a better pulse of what's going on day to day, second to second at times. And I've watched guys sit there and watch tape before a fight or before a game, excuse me, of who they might be fighting. Do they throw left? What's their approach when they drop the gloves? How much prep did you do before a game knowing you might have to throw down?
Yeah, a lot, especially when, you know, hockey fights came into, you know, fruition. You could watch fights on your phone in the hotel room before the fight. So I think once I made the NHL, that's when it started to really kind of become a preparation type thing. In the AHL, I didn't know a thing. I would just go out there and you try to gather some information from the other team's trainers or your trainers. It's like, is this guy a lefty? What does he like to do? How does he fight? I had no idea in the AHL. In the NHL, you know who you were going to fight. It's like, okay, we're going in. I'm going to fight, you know, Brian McGrattan, or I'm going to fight George Parros. So we're going to fight, you know, Steve Mack. You knew who you're going to fight and you knew how they fought and you could watch video. So yeah, I would spend countless hours all night watching videos and losing sleep. And it was almost a bad thing because you would just over prepare and you would watch these guys beat up other guys. And you're like, oh, they're tougher. And you make them out to be these invincible people who, you know, are going to kill you. But you know, I'm bigger. I used to just be up all night. I remember it was like second or third year. My wife woke up and she was laying beside me. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, they got a new young guy coming up. I need to prepare. And I've been watching videos. It was like 2-3 in the morning. And she's like, how big is this guy? And I was like, oh, he's 6'2", 230. She goes, how big are you, dummy? And I was like, I don't know, 6'8", 270. And she's like, go to bed. He's terrified of you. What are you doing? I was like, oh, that makes sense. So I just went to sleep. But yeah, it's good. Technology in many ways is good and bad. You can prepare, but you can just over prepare and you're just like mind screwing yourself.
I've got to ask you obviously about the 2016 NHL All-Star Game. And ironically enough, the last guest I had on the podcast was Greg Wyshynski, longtime writer and blogger. And he's part of the reason, is my understanding, you got voted in to the All-Star Game that year. It was the fan vote. It was when social media was, I guess, really starting to take a rise. And it went viral. Get John Scott in the NHL All-Star Game. I know there's a lot that goes into this story, but I've got to ask you what that experience was like in Nashville to play an All-Star weekend, to win the MVP, and how much fun that was for you, even though obviously it might have been a little chaotic with the fan vote and possibly the league pushing back and all that stuff.
Well, it was incredible. I think the end result is fantastic. You know, I got to do this. I got to get the money and the car and all the accolades, and the fans were all there. But the lead up to that point was brutal because I was just getting ripped apart by everybody and their brother. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? You're going to be embarrassed. You're not a good hockey player. You're a goon. Everything you could imagine. I would open up the paper and it would just be like, this is a joke. The Mike Milberrys of the world, who were still like just all over me up until even before like the game, they were just ripping me a new one. And
yeah,
so
they wouldn't let it go.
Wouldn't let it go. Yeah. And it was like, come on, you guys, I'm here. Just let it go. But I think former tough guys really got me through it. Current tough guys, they would reach out, which was really great. The Kelly Chases, the Rob Rays, the Stu Grimsons, the Ty Domies, those types, the Marty McSorleys, everybody reached out. And overwhelmingly, they were just like, you should do this. This is a good thing. You need to go and represent our brand because we are good hockey players and we can keep up. And so I went for it because the NHL was doing their damnedest to try to not let me go. They were offering me all kinds of money and vacations and incentives to not play. And then they obviously get me traded and sent down and everything blows up in their face. But it was a good way to go out. Obviously, it was a fairy tale ending and I'll never forget it. And the guys I got to do it with was super great because I was good friends with Jumbo and Joe Pavelski and Brent Burns and those types. And I got to meet, you know, other great guys like Quickie and, you know, Dowdy and those guys. And I can't remember what Sedin it was with, but one of those Sedins was with me too. So it was a neat weekend for sure. And my twins were born the next day. So it kind of worked out. It was a pretty neat 4-day stretch there.
Wow. You scored 2 goals. You win MVP. I watched some of the highlights the other day. The team in the Pacific Division, your teammates, they had you up on their shoulders, which I'm sure was a tall task for them to pull off. That just had to be an amazing, and you hit Patrick Kane, you flattened him for crying out loud, Big John. What were you thinking there?
He's in the trolley tracks, Joe. You know, I was just like, do I let this kid dangle me and make everybody write like you can't keep up, or you finish a check? And it wasn't hard. Like, I really could have buried
him.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah.
I just kind of stepped into him a little bit. If I would have scored, it would have been the icing on the cake, you know, but I just buried it. And I think it was, who's the Nashville goalie, that tall guy?
Pecorino.
I buried it in his chest and I'm like, damn it. But yeah, couple hits, couple fights, you know, it was the prototypical John Scott game.
Prototypical John Scott game. I love that line because, I mean, you knew your game better than anybody. You had already played with Kane at that point. So what did he make of that moment?
Oh, he thought it was, yeah, he ended up getting the rebound off of my missed breakaway and going down and burying. So he was all fun. Then we got in the little fight.
Yeah.
But it was all in good fun. I think that's the NHL All-Star game was, it was still kind of floundering. No one knew what to do with it. The ratings were terrible. And I think my whole thing resurrected a little bit and it got some interest. And the NHL really realized that this can be a good thing because they were thinking of canceling it altogether and just, you know, doing away with it because nobody was watching it. It was a waste of time. The players didn't try. I feel like we had a really competitive All-Star game and it was fun to watch and the fans really liked it. So I don't know. It was a good time.
Where's the Honda that you won that day for All-Star game MVP?
The Honda only seated, I think, 7. So I had to sell it.
Well, it probably wasn't made for a 6'8" guy to begin with.
No, I drove it for a little bit. It was a little tight. It had a beautiful vehicle. But yeah, we sold it and upgraded to one of those Nissan NV that seats 12 and just kind of, it's a massive bus. So that's what we're driving now.
All right, so the game ends. It's in Nashville, and I was going to ask you about if you spent the night or if it's All-Star game weekend, so everybody just jets right away. But you were having, your twins were on their way. So what was that post-game like? Are you checking in with your wife? Like, how'd that all go down?
Yeah, we actually, so my agent based in Minnesota, Ben Hankinson with Octagon Hockey, he was there, and one of his other clients was Dustin Byfuglien, Minnesota guy. So we had a little room made up, and so we had Dustin Byfuglien and his family and me and my family and our agents, and we went out and had a nice dinner, and then we were out the door. Like, we flew out at, like, 5 a.m. because we had to get to the hospital for the birth. It was funny, on the flight out, Milbury was on the same flight, and he wouldn't even look at me. It was so funny. He was just such a coward in line. And I was trying to catch his eye and say hi or just, like, you know, acknowledge
him. Just give him a look. Yeah.
Give him a look. And he wouldn't even look at me. He's such a coward. But yeah, we had a nice dinner and just jetted out of there pretty early.
All right. Some current NHL stuff before I cut you loose. I really appreciate your time, John. The Minnesota Wild, they just acquired Pat Maroon last week. What do you make of the move?
I think they had to get something. You lost Greenway last year, a little more toughness, help out Marcus Foligno a little bit. I don't know how much gas in the tank Maroon has. He's obviously, you know, the Cups follow him wherever he goes. Hopefully that happens in Minnesota, but he'll be good. I think you limit his minutes. You play him, what, 7 to 10 minutes a night, and he'll do fine. I think he'll maybe help out in the second power play unit a little bit. He brings that Stanley Cup pedigree. He'll help the younger guys, but gosh, the salary cap implications from Suter and Parisi are just too much. It's a lot to overcome, but hopefully the Wild can just get through this year and, you know, greener days are ahead, hopefully.
Free agency wise, I saw on Twitter, you really liked what the Toronto Maple Leafs have done. I guess the obvious question would be why, but I think we all know why. A lot of pieces added. What do you like about their potential mix, I guess, chemistry wise and the ability they have to play maybe some different ways now this year coming up?
Yeah, I think they were very predictable with their game plan. They were going to try to run and gun you. They were going to try to finesse you. And that's the only way they could play. And they added guys who give them a different element of game. Now they can rough it up. They can play in their face. If they get down a goal, they can, you know, get some momentum by having some physical play with Bertuzzi, Domi, Reeves. Those are guys who can change the tempo of a game. And I just like that move. And then the biggest move, I think, is the John Klingberg on the back end. He gives them a solid top four with Riley, Brody, McCabe, and Klingberg. I think before then you had Justin Hall, you had other guys in there. It just didn't work. So I don't know, the Leafs, the goaltending is always the issue with them. It's been that way for years. If they could figure out how to get Ilya Samsonov signed and just get rid of that drama with the Matt Murray, they will be a good team. But again, they're great in the regular season. Playoffs, they seem to just shut it down. But I think, I don't know, I'm not a big Leafs fan, but this is their best team that I've seen on paper. It's their most balanced team. They have three really, really dangerous lines, and then they have a good fourth line who can just do a lot of different things, kill penalties, bang, fight. I like it. I like the Leafs this year, strange to say.
Earlier when you were talking about Marian Gaborik, you brought up the reigning MVP and Connor McDavid. What are we seeing with him, with his almost nightly dominance, and just how damn good is he?
Well, he's the best that's ever laced him up. I think he's the best player ever on earth to ever play hockey, right? Like, it's special what he does.
Wait, you really mean that? Like, yeah, you don't think it's too early for that?
No, I think if he broke his back tomorrow and he never played another game, he is the most talented player ever to play the game. Why would you not say that? I think he plays in an era that is really good defensively. The goalies are the best they've ever been. The game planning around players is so much better than it was even 20 years ago, where teams literally focus on Connor McDavid every single game and he still puts up 150 points. He still does whatever he wants. He's an incredible player. I think when we look back on this, when we're all crusty and I'm getting close to it, we're going to say, damn, that guy was unbelievable. We'll never see a guy with his just everything. He does everything, Joe. He's a really, really great hockey player. And what's crazy is the second best player in the league is Leon Draisaitl. And he's just kind of just riding McDavid's coattails, so to speak. But I think they have the top two players in the league. Like, they're both incredible. So, I don't know. I really – they're not going to win a cup because they don't have the talent around them. And their defense is not great. But those two guys are just incredible.
So, Gretzky, Messier, Lemieux, Jager, McDavid, Draisaitl, you're putting the current Oilers star duo right there and maybe even ahead of those duos?
I think right now they would probably, just because longevity, right? Lemieux and Jager won Stanley Cups. So did Messier and Gretzky. And you have to weigh that into the factor. Sure. So I think they would be third right now, just on overall work. But if they get a couple cups, which I don't think they will, unfortunately, like they'd be right up there. Cause you could also, like, there's Thornton Marlowe who never won a cup. There's right. Duos that didn't win cups who just were incredible, but Connor McDavid doing what he's doing is it's special. It really is.
Tell our listeners about Dropping the Gloves podcast, where they can find it, how often episodes are produced, and sort of the origin of it. Love the name, obviously. Fits yeah. well for your brand. And you got some intro music too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, the intro, some band in San Jose just shot me. I asked somebody to do an intro and they did an intro song. It's fantastic. I'm going to use it forever. But yeah, Dropping the Gloves, find it wherever you do podcasts. We're doing okay. I think we're top five in the U.S., top 10 in Canada. We got good content, good guests. We're family friendly. That's kind of what we hang our hat on. We don't cuss. We don't talk about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We just keep it nice and PG, but it's also fun. So give it a listen. It's funny how it came about where when I retired, I got some offers to work for TSN and Sportsnet, but I would have to, do it out of Toronto. And I just like, I don't want to go to Toronto. I don't want to leave anymore. So we just like, let's do this new thing called a podcast. And it started off slow. And now we built it up to, I think it's a pretty good show.
All right. Quick hits. I call it. These are going to be first thing that comes to mind. I got a couple for you. Ready?
Yep.
What did you say to Phil Kessel right before the incident where he was taking baseball bat swings at you and all heck broke loose in that game?
I said, Phil, I'm sorry, but I got to jump you.
Name the goalies you scored on for your five career NHL goals. You mentioned Cam Ward earlier, so I guess give me the other four goalies you scored on.
Jonas Miller, Braden Holtby, empty net goal, And I don't know the other one.
Empty net goal. I love it. You don't know.
Oh, Jonathan Bernier. Bernier from Toronto.
All right. Favorite interview guest you've had on your podcast?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have to go with maybe the most recent, Ryan Reeves. Great, great guest.
Give me a current NHL player you love watching today, not named Connor McDavid.
Not named McDavid. I like Brady Tkachuk.
Favorite restaurant on the road?
Oh, gosh, that's a good one. I was a burger and fries guy, so I'm fairly really? Boring. But, yeah, I'm so cheap, Joe, where we would go out to eat, and I wouldn't go because I knew it was going to be like a couple hundred dollars. So I would just get room service and have wings and pizza. That's was my go-to. But I think in Vancouver, they had a good sushi bar. I can't remember what it was called. But, yeah, I was so incredibly cheap. It's just disgusting.
Well, you would you'd like the way AHL per diem has grown these days. Way more than 2007 or whenever you broke into the league. So.
Well, because we would get like $25 a day, yeah. Something like that.
Well, yeah, those San Antonio trips, like the day trip, I think you got $20 because you left in the afternoon. And it was ride after the practice back. In Sugar Land. Yeah, you'd be bussed back after the game.
The best thing about the NHL, well, one of the best things, you'd go on like a 10-day road trip and they'd give you the per diem at the start and they'd hand you an envelope for like $2,000. Yeah. Like, what?
It was always mind-blowing.
When I first got
me.
It, I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you had guys making then, and now millions and millions of dollars and they were handing you an envelope of cash so you could pay for some of your meals.
Like, and no one would use it. Well, we would gamble with it. So you'd go on the plane and you'd all have these envelopes, crisp hundreds in there. And you would cut cards. I remember in Minnesota, my first year, you'd throw your envelope on the table and you're like, all right, high card gets the envelopes.
Wow.
Yeah. And you'd walk away. You could walk away with like $5,000, $6,000 before you even get your chair. So it was like, I never had any other team that gambled as much as the Wild did when I was with the Wild. It was awesome.
Did you do okay?
Yeah. Cause there's
overall.
I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I had a degree. I was fairly smart and logical and not hot-headed. And, these guys, if their pride was so tied up in the card game, if they would lose, they would just, I'm going again. I'm like, fine. Yeah. Rebuy, Gabby. He'd reach into his Gucci thing and pull out another whatever and throw on the table. I made more money in the card table than I did with my contract that year.
Get out of here.
No, I would kill it. I would absolutely kill it at the card table.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Those flights weren't long enough for you. You were hoping for cross country trips.
I'm like, we
all
need
the time.
A European game. We need to go to Finland. Let's go.
John, thanks so much for doing this. This interview went down a lot of different paths that I probably didn't even consider. Thanks for sharing some memories and really keep up the great work. Very happy for the success you eventually had after we crossed paths and continue to have. Good luck with the television work coming your way and keep up all the good work on Dropping the Gloves and all that busy family
time. All
that
good stuff. Thanks, Joe. Awesome, the same buddy. To you, man. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, that's John Scott, former NHLer. A lot of fun. Thanks again to SodaStick for sponsoring One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell, and we'll catch you next time.